We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. Hey, where's my jet?
Spoiler warning for Black Christmas, The Witch, and Hereditary. Trigger warning for discussion of gendered violence. Music-free version available at jetpack1917.info.
Kia ora koutou. Welcome, comrades, to Where's My Jetpack, a politics and pop culture podcast with sci-fi and socialist leanings. This month we have a very special guest speaking on social reproduction, feminisms, and horror. So Joanna Isaacson writes academic and popular pieces on horror and politics. She is a professor of English at Modesto Junior College and a founding editor of Blindfield Journal. She is the author of Stepford Daughters, Weapons for Feminist and Contemporary Horror from Common Notions, which is what we'll be mainly discussing in this episode, and also of The Ballerina and the Bull from Repeater Books. She has published widely in academic and popular journals, including with Annie McClanahan, The Entry for Marxism and Horror in the Sage Handbook of Marxism. She runs the Facebook group Anti-Capitalist Feminists Who Like Horror Films, which I'm also a member of. Welcome to the show, Jo.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's great to be here.
Thanks for coming. Definitely found your work quite useful in terms of our own kind of horror analysis and commentary on this podcast. So it's good to finally have you on. Since we're going to be talking about kind of horror and feminism, and that can be a bit contentious sometimes. So for the skeptical, how do you respond to claims that horror is a sexist genre?
Yeah, well, I don't want to deny that there's probably people out there that watch horror because they enjoy watching violence to women or seeing scantily clad women have violent acts done to them. But I think as a whole, it really is a genre that offers up a whole lot to feminists. For one, it's kind of a source of realism, I find. And you can think about it by contrasting it to something like the rom-com, where you'll have a kind of meet cute and the guy will be kind of pushy and kind of not taking no for an answer. But in the rom-com, it all turns out fine. They fall in love. The misunderstandings are overcome. Whereas, you know, you can even see with the recent film, you know, Barbarian or other horror films, that the kind of aggressions that kind of show up that are red flags in horror, we can actually see the real violence that subtends some of that, that's kind of taboo to talk about in other genres. And I think that there's a whole lot of my favorite critics on horror who've found the feminist kind of implications of the genre, such as Robin Wood, the queer horror theorist from the 70s, really looked at the way that the monsters of horror were able to represent everything that we kind of repress and oppress as other, and in the name of maintaining a kind of heteronormative, patriarchal normality. And the monsters, if we look at it the right way through a feminist lens, we can really see all those kind of qualities and people who are othered and ostracized in these monsters, and also our own psychological desires that are repressed, and we can see them in those monsters. Or you can look at Tony Williams, who makes the case that horror is the place where we can kind of strip down some of the idealism around the family and the way that every other genre really wants to imagine the family as this place of warmth and safety. Whereas in horror, you kind of see the hearths of darkness, as he calls them, where the family is a kind of place where real violence can happen, even though it's supposed to be a shelter. Or, you know, Barbara Creed, who talks about the idea of the monstrous feminine and the idea that, you know, horror is the place where we can really acknowledge how much our culture is based on kind of abjecting and othering, you know, so-called female qualities and calling women irrational, you know, emotional, and then kind of denigrating those qualities, or looking at women's bodies, their menstruation, their childbirth, their menopause as disgusting and grotesque and kind of creating monsters on that model. So all of these ideas, it's just a rich genre for these ideas and these taboo topics that are of such concern to feminists.
Yeah, you mentioned Barbarian. I thought that dealt in a really interesting way with kind of relationship between what you could call kind of housing crisis horror, but also kind of post-Me Too questions of like sexual violence. Not that these questions are actually that new, but, you know, it felt very informed by that sort of that recent sort of trend in popular culture and that. But your book is titled Stepford Daughters, obviously referencing the Stepford Wives, which most people know what that means, but, you know, is the image of subordination of women in suburbia. So what's meant by Stepford daughter? What are the commonalities and differences with the previous generation of Stepford wives?
So as you say, most people know what the film Stepford Wives is, you know, of this kind of idea of women who are creative and independent going to the suburbs and being kind of subordinated into these roles of mother and wife and nothing else. And I think that that film goes along really well with this kind of second wave feminist idea put forth by Betty Friedan, that the problem with No Name, the most crucial problem to feminists, was the kind of terror of being just trapped in the house as a housewife and having very little independence and life of one's own. But for Friedan, the way to get out of that dilemma was to enter into the workforce. And so my argument with Stepford Daughters is that we have inherited our generations, you know, X and Zoomers and millennials have inherited the problems of the Stepford Wives, where there's still a lot of pressure to maintain the household, to be the perfect mother, to be, you know, the beautiful wife, etc. But that Friedan's answer, most of us or many of us are forced to have jobs, and Friedan's answer has not really served us well. In fact, the very kinds of oppressions that were developed in the household of having to do emotional labor, of having to do reproductive labor that is devalued and naturalized, has actually spread rather than been contained by the work world. And we do those kinds of feminized labor in the work world, in our service work, in our socially reproductive work. And this doesn't just apply to women, but to men too. Men in many ways are feminized in the contemporary workforce as we do the essential jobs that help reproduce human beings. I think that horror is very canny about understanding this transformation. And you can see it in a film like The Babadook, where the main character, Amelia, is terrorized by her home life. She's expected to be this single mother who supports a troubled child without any support, without any help from social services or family. She no longer has what the Stepford wife did have in her household, which was the male wage, which was a kind of social agreement that men could earn enough to support a family, which wasn't good for women because women were basically, you know, servants to the men. But the male wage has not been replaced by a female wage that a woman can support a family or even half a family in many cases. Amelia in Babadook inherits all these problems of the Stepford wife, but she also does have a job. She works in a nursing home. And those same kind of forms of care and suppression that she must experience in the domestic household, she also experiences in her workplace as she's paid very little, as she's not treated well, as she must kind of pour out emotional labor but not receive much in return. So I think that Stepford Daughters kind of way to acknowledge that feminized or sort of patriarchy and its relationship to capitalism is kind of sustained through different generations, but it mutates. And popular culture, especially the horror genre, can help us sort of unpack the way that it's working in our moment.
You mentioned relationship between capitalism and patriarchy at the end there. So yeah, how does contemporary horror show the relationship between capitalism and patriarchy? And also, what might that imply about the sort of historically troubled relationship between Marxism and feminism?
I think that there's kind of a parallel, maybe misreading of our conditions, both in sort of the political criticism and in criticism of horror. You can see, you know, back in the late 70s, again, kind of some second wave forms of feminism, there was this idea that there's dual systems, you know, there's patriarchy and there's capitalism. And these are two different forms of oppression. And, you know, the theorists that I'm really interested in are, you know, Marxist feminists, socialist feminists, anarchist feminists, social reproduction feminists, who understand what I think to be true is that there is no way to extricate gender and capitalism, and that, in fact, capitalism relies on the striation and the hierarchicalization of gender and race. That has always been how it has operated. I find it so fascinating to look at Silvia Federici's narration of the transformation from feudalism to capitalism. So right at the inception of capitalism, she reads it through a sort of gendered horror show where she looks at, you know, before the advent of capitalism, there was, you know, public lands where men and women worked on a fairly equal basis. And then she talks about, you know, the privatization that capitalism enacted and the sort of forced sort of transformation where men were made to go from this sort of public land to the factories to work for a wage. And she asks, you know, how can we make these men go to the factory, which is clearly an undesirable way of life. And she looks at the way that capitalism sort of imposed gendered spheres where men would go to the factory to earn the wage and women would basically be confined to the household to be their servants, to do reproductive labor, to have their children, to clean the house, to make the food, and that that labor would be seen as less valuable and that the man's position in the family would be the boss. And she asked, were women forced into this position with the advent of capitalism? And her answer is the witch hunts. You know, this is the advent of the witch, that women who disobeyed that kind of mandate to become subordinate and passive reproductive laborers in the home were burned at the stake as witches, were executed, were massacred, or women who tried to control their own biological reproduction, or midwives, you know, were also labeled as witches. And so this kind of creation of gendered spheres to support capitalism was there right at the beginning, and it transforms, but it's still really imposed, as I was saying before, where the kinds of labor that are attributed to women are often devalued. They're considered natural, and because they're considered lower value and natural, they're underpaid, they're ignored, they're made invisible. And that's true for the housewife in the home or for the housekeeper who's worked for wage domestic labor in somebody else's home, or people who are doing service work out in the world. There's a way in which the reason their labor can be devalued is because it has historically been feminized. And I think that horror, again, does a really good job of kind of showing how that works. So you can look at Robert Eggers, the film The Witch, and the way that the young girl who is serving her family and being super mistreated by her family is labeled a witch for her sort of sexuality, right? Just any kind of vision of sexuality. But that film and others also show the kind of power of reclaiming the term of the witch and kind of using it as a kind of identity to fight back. And other films also show the sort of problem and misdiagnosis that a kind of dual systems approach takes when there's a kind of imagination that the lean-in feminism has kind of solved the problem of feminism. And the fact that we have women leaders and women in positions of authority has gotten rid of this problem, rather than looking at the structural kind of gendered spheres and the ways that reproductive labor has continued to be devalued. And that's where you get people actually saying, like, these right-wing leaders in Italy and England, you know, that happen to be women are sort of a sign that we're in a post-feminist moment. You can look at something like Bong Joon-ho, Snowpiercer, where he has Tilda Swinton plays this kind of Margaret Thatcher-like character who's the boss of this train, that's post-apocalyptic train. And she's got a lot of power in that horror film, but she just uses that power to terrorize the lower classes that are kind of in the back of the train and confined there. So it kind of shows how a woman in power who leans in is not solving the problem of capitalism or feminism, and that this, we can't really take this idea of a separate dual system, that patriarchy and capitalism must be fought together. So I really love these new horror kind of inventions to kind of capture that reality.
Thanks. And can you talk about that comes from inside the house, both in cinema and more generally?
Yeah, you know, I have a chapter that talks about the kind of idea of the horror that comes from inside the house. It comes from a kind of 70s film that depicts a babysitter, and she's getting these horrific calls that are like from some man that are threatening her, threatening the children she's babysitting. And at some point, she realizes that these calls are not coming from some stranger outside the house, but they're actually coming from inside the house. And I thought that was a kind of cool metaphor, that the home and the family in sort of mythology and ideology is always this place that's a shelter, that's safe, that's a place that outside of the struggle of capitalism or outside of the dangerous world that surrounds it, and that the house is kind of a place of protection. But, you know, as many women know, it can be a place of terror. You know, there's physical domestic abuse. There's just the boredom and terror, that, you know, of endless housework that really doesn't have any kind of time off, or of the pressures to be always the perfect mother, never complain about your situation. And so horror, again, like, you know, I was saying with this Tony Williams idea of the hearths of darkness, is a place that really can expose that terror that can beset women inside the house. While also, again, in this generation, acknowledging that that kind of terror that's been cultivated in the privacy of the home where violence can be hidden is also spreading into the larger world. So a film like Hereditary, I think, is really interesting for that, where Annie, the protagonist, is kind of in this family, and it's depicted as such an over-the-top, like, tragic scenario. So all the things that are kind of sad about the family are blown up into this theatrical horror where, you know, the daughter doesn't just die, she's decapitated, and the husband doesn't just leave, he's burnt up in flames, and the son doesn't just disobey, but he's like turned into a demon who decapitates everybody around him. But the scariest thing actually in that film, I think, is when they try to sit down to the dinner table as a family and just talk, because all their emotions are so bottled up and they can't express anything about how they're feeling towards each other, because they're supposed to act one way and they're feeling this other way. And it's so taboo to just speak your mind with your family in some cases. And so for that chapter, I was really influenced by the idea espoused by people like Kathy Weeks, Sophie Lewis, Michelle O'Brien, of family abolition, which I think is a very kind of almost punk rock horror feminist theory in a way, in that it's kind of, it's so bold, basically, you know. And whenever anybody hears about it, this idea that we should abolish the family, they're like, oh my God, the feminists are going to destroy everything. They're going to destroy our social fabric in every way. But, you know, actually, when you listen to what they're talking about with family abolition, they're just saying, look, families can love each other, they can be great, but they cannot stand what capitalism is doing to them. What capitalism does with this myth of the family is externalize all the care that should be provided to people, and say that the family has to provide all that care, has to do all that work of maintaining them. And that is a horror show. A, because sometimes the family just can't do it. It doesn't have any money to care for each other. And you can see that, you know, our supposedly family values culture tears apart families at the border who have just come there just to try to survive, right? So if they can't care for themselves, we don't really consider them a family. B, if you're, say, queer or don't play by the rules of your family, say you're a queer person in a fundamentalist family, then you are shit out of luck, you know, for lack of better terms. You can't get that care from the family and there's nowhere else to get it. So families would be great if they were voluntary and not mandatory. And if people who wanted to organize themselves in other kinds of social formations, other kinds of forms of care, had that option. But in fact, capitalism is preys on the form of the family by refusing to let people criticize it and then using it as a form of free labor to support its own expansion and profit. And I think The Hearths of Darkness in horror, you know, another movie I think is really good for this is this Japanese film called Dark Waters that shows this single woman who is trying to, you know, take care of her daughter. And she is just stretched so thin, she can't be two places at once. She has to work to support her daughter. She has to pick her daughter up from school. So her daughter ends up just sitting outside of the, you know, school for hours. But the real horror and the real monster in the movie ends up being the infrastructure of the city they live in, where there's water leaking into their apartment. There's water killing children around them because it's not maintained. And it just shows that she's doing everything she can to be the best mother possible. But if capitalism is externalizing all that care and not even providing basic services like water and energy or whatever you need to maintain a family, then your whole world is going to be turned upside down and your house is going to be invaded by water and muck and all the evils of the world if you can't have those basic services. So I really like think horror is very canny about the horror coming from inside the house, from inside the family, and not allowing those myths to prevail.
That line, the call is coming from inside the house, obviously very, very culturally definitive, as Black Christmas was the film. We've actually sampled that in a previous year and recommended it. Yeah, Black Christmas, definite, early definitive slash film. Thanks for that, all that. The way horror symptomatically kind of represents the horror inside the house is very helpful. But your work embraces camp in general. Can you define camp and explain what you value about it?
Sure. Yeah. So I think of camp as it's a form of excess. It's a form of artifice. It's an aesthetic that's very queer. And I think I really agree with Harry Benshoff, who's a kind of queer horror theorist, who, you know, sees really all monsters in horror on some level as queer. And I think that a lot of them are using this kind of camp aesthetic to sort of show that queerness. And he makes the case that the reason he sees all monsters as queer is because monsters are so disruptive to everything that's considered normal in Western civilization. They're really, you know, the other and the repressed, like I was mentioning with Robin Wood, also feels this way. And so he kind of makes this syllogism is like queer is to heteronormativity as sort of monster is to all of sort of Western civilization. So we can kind of, since that's been such an enduring taboo. And so you can see kind of queer camp in horror in all kinds of ways. I love the story, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of, you know, how the Babadook kind of became this queer symbol. You know, the Babadook is this monster that is very kind of expressionistic, very over the top. When, you know, this kind of dowdy housewife kind of takes him in, she becomes very excessive and campy, you know, always in a rage or in a passion, or her emotions overflow. She's larger than life. And sort of by accident, but sort of not, the Babadook ended up becoming a kind of queer icon for, I think it was 2020 Pride, and people had great fun showing how it kind of symbolized a kind of queer fabulousness and extravagance that I think is true of many, many horror monsters. And I think, you know, at the heart of camp, what I love about it is there's a kind of implicit political demand, and you can kind of contrast it to, say, normative, like gay versus queer, normative gay rights. You're asking for tolerance. You're asking, can we please just get married? Can we please just have kids? And of course, we want all that, you know, we want those rights. But the demand at the heart of camp is so much more. It's so much more excessive. It's like a kind of demand for desire and passion. It's a demand for being really extra. It's a demand or kind of the we want everything sort of mentality, right? And camp is also very much in contrast to the idea of authenticity. So camp makes itself understood as, you know, something that's constructed and not just something that's natural. And I think that's really useful for thinking about, you know, estranging like gender normativity and kind of playing into sort of trans narratives and this kind of thing of like imagining that everything is something that we can decide on what our genders should be. We don't have to obey some kind of natural laws. It kind of makes it evident. Another very campy kind of queer horror movie that I like that kind of exemplifies some of these ideas is Teeth, which is about a sort of a young woman coming of age. And as she's coming into her own sexuality, she's encountering the real world that kind of prohibits all that sexuality, you know, whether it's Christian fundamentalism, whether it's rape culture. And at the same time, she discovers that she has vagina dentata. Basically, her vagina is a monster. In, you know, a less campy narrative, maybe the goal would be, well, like, maybe I don't want vagina dentata. I just want to have a normal body and a normal life. But in Teeth, it's really an embrace of that, you know, monstrosity that she has. And when she realizes how to use it, she gets to finally like tell her own story, create her own sexuality. She has a way of fighting back against rapists and sort of other antagonists. And there's one point where she like goes through a book and looks at all the kind of historic mythology of men fighting the vagina dentata. Instead, she gets to kind of write her own myth. So I think these kind of extravagant monsters and images that are kind of silly on some level also have a kind of serious politics to them that I love.
Yeah, Teeth is definitely a great film. And I think something quite good on that, which I think we both enjoyed, was the Queer for Fear series on Shudder, which was basically looking back at queerness and horror and talked a lot about kind of queer monstrosity. And I also found out from watching that how many of my favorite 90s teen horror was from gay creators, and I didn't realize. So being very basic, I'm a huge fan of The Craft, and it was fantastic to find out that Andrew Fleming, who wrote and directed it, was gay and was being interviewed in the series. And then Kevin Williamson wrote one of my favorite horror movies, Scream, which obviously, again, probably a lot of people would consider quite basic, but I had no idea that he was also gay. So it was kind of nice to just, as a good analysis of horror and the history of queerness and horror, going back a bit earlier, like directors like James Whale. Also how gay horror is, like to an extent that I hadn't even realized that a lot of the things I most enjoyed were like deeply, deeply gay. And it all tracks, you know, like you watch The Craft and yeah, it tracks that a gay man wrote and directed this. Thanks for that. And can you explain the extension of, this is obviously something a chapter of your book deals with, but can you explain the extension of global care chains and how that's both concealed and revealed in horror?
Yeah, sure. You say one of my chapters is kind of concerned with this. It's instead of saying it's coming from inside the house, it's coming from inside the boss's house. And, you know, one thing that I want to correct with that, even though I've kind of put it out there, is, you know, we can think of social reproduction in terms of the housewife. But as Angela Davis argues, that if we kind of think about that problem of feminized labor through the housewife, we're really ignoring that, you know, women of color have almost never gotten to just stay home and do unwaged work. They've always done that work unwaged and done waged work for others, so, and had a kind of double burden, as Angela Davis puts it, to do that work. You know, with contemporary transformations, globalization, you know, the kind of compression of space and time, this has become exacerbated with many more women of color doing the work inside people's homes, as well as other forms of care work. Again, this is a really good way to think about how oppression works. It's not just intersectionality, which I think sometimes really is thinking about identity and how it affects people, but what Elena Glenn Nakana calls like interlocking oppressions, where it's kind of what you do every day within your activities, there's sort of multiple oppression for people who are doing the most oppressed work, right, of doing waged domestic work for others. I think horror, again, is really good at kind of getting at this as horror. One of the strategies that I've seen in horror that I think is really cool is like in a couple of films I look at, Housekeeping and The Maid. The Maid is a little bit more well known. It's about a kind of Filipina domestic worker in Singapore. There's this kind of escalating horror that happens in these films where at first they're doing sort of annoying, yucky tasks of domestic labor. You know, it's no fun to clean a bathtub. It's no fun to, you know, clean out cobwebs from something. But there's a gradual escalation of the terror in those domestic chores where, you know, you gradually come to realize that there's a kind of continuum with just the oppression that is kind of every day in, you know, wage domestic work and the real sort of horror and violence behind the relationship that we have to wage domestic workers. I also look at Get Out, which, you know, obviously has been talked about kind of to death. But one thing I haven't seen talked about quite as much is the fact that all the kind of horror conventions come out in the extreme when you look at the domestic workers in Get Out. Whenever you see the maid or the groundskeeper, that's when you get the spooky music and the canted camera angles and the jump cuts and this kind of thing. Those characters are kind of, you know, obeying the kind of horror convention of the uncanny. Those are the things that kind of make us see the world askew. And I like the idea of the uncanny in horror because it's a word that means that which is the most intimate and homely is also kind of the strangest, right? That the things that we think are sort of familiar are also unfamiliar. And in Get Out, I think it does a really good job of showing how the domestic workers, what is uncanny about them is that they've really been robbed of their lives. Their work is not just like, oh, 9-to-5 oppression, but then I get to go home and be myself. Their lives are taken over by their bosses. They're taken over by their jobs. They're banished to the sunken place, right, in Get Out. And so there's a way in which I think that kind of depicts the way that domestic labor is working right now, where people are really robbed of their lives and of their sort of capability to have their own sort of even mental life as people are taken away from their families, their children to take care of other people's children. And Get Out also does a lot to use the kind of gothic mode where you see kind of people banished to kind of unconscious states to tie in that domestic work to a sort of legacy of racialized terror, right? And so showing how this is the latest advent of the way that race and gender are kind of used to create this most oppressed class. There's not as much horror as I would like to see that kind of depicts the position of the sort of racialized domestic worker. But when it does happen, it's really powerful. And you can contrast it with something like Roma, which by kind of trying to tell the story of a maid in a kind of realist vein, ends up kind of romanticizing that work, ends up kind of saying, oh, she works hard, but she and the family love each other. And it's really kind of an intimate relationship. Whereas the horror genre doesn't have those same emotional rules that it has to romanticize that relationship and instead can really expose the violence that's more taboo to talk about in the kind of conditions of domestic worker.
Yeah, thanks. One point you talk about in your book and elsewhere, which I found really helpful in relation to Get Out, was how Jordan Peele quite openly cites Stepford Wives as an influence on it. And you sort of talk about how the relationship between Stepford Wives and Get Out. Do you want to talk about that?
You know, I think it's just amazing way that you see the kind of influence between sort of thinking about gender and race. So in Get Out, Georgina, who is the maid, her body is taken over by the matriarch of the house. She is kind of serving the family, but at times she kind of glitches and the real self kind of comes out. And in the Stepford Wives, there's a kind of similar move where the women who are turned to robots to just be the perfect wives and mothers kind of glitch, and you can see that they're not really smoothly and naturally doing these roles. So it's a kind of, you know, what Brecht would call, I guess, an estrangement effect that Get Out kind of inherits from the Stepford Wives. And that's another thing that I really love in horror, is the way that it kind of takes things that we see as natural and shows their uncanny, strange side. And so, you know, there's even an expression, you know, there's nothing more natural than a mother's love, and something that's kind of implied in something like Roma, you know, there's nothing more natural than the kind of intimacy between a maid who takes care of children and the children. It denaturalizes those, and it does it through similar moves, so you can see the continuity between those different kinds of oppressions, of gendered and racialized oppressions.
Thanks. And I mean, this kind of flows really directly onto the next question. So discussing emotional labor or the performance of emotion for wages, I mean, that's the original basis of that concept. You ask, what would happen if we went on a smile strike? And you sort of celebrate the emergence of monsters concealed beneath the smile. Can you go into that refusal of emotional labor in horror?
Yeah, sure. My subtitle for that chapter is, you know, the telltale managed heart, sort of playing with Edgar Allan Poe's idea of the telltale heart. That's this kind of heart that's beating in the walls that kind of haunts us. But thinking about it alongside Arlie Hochschild's idea of the managed heart. And she was a sociologist in the 80s who first kind of studied stewardesses and the kind of emotional labor that they had to do in their jobs. And, you know, she looked at the ways that emotional labor, to do it really well, you had to do something that she calls like deep acting, where you don't just kind of perform a certain emotional disposition of the big smile or the friendliness, or no matter, you know, how much your customers are jerks to you, but you kind of become that persona and you kind of take it home with you. And the way that that kind of estranges you from your own emotions and makes your whole life in some ways, you know, your job. And, you know, when I was writing the book, I didn't have these amazing examples of how horror can address that, but these new movies that are coming out, like Smile, is all about that, right? Of how creepy a smile is because it's not your own. Or the like 10 minute or something smile that Mia Goth does at the end of Pearl just shows how uncanny and strange a woman's smile can be when it's forced in these various situations. In the chapter, I do talk about the film Maps to the Stars, which shows a kind of personal assistant to a kind of actress and how, you know, she's so good at it. She's able to be right on key for everything that her boss wants. She'll, you know, watch her go to the bathroom. She'll get her cozy food she wants. You know, she'll agree with everything she says. And part of how she does this is she like subscribes to kind of new age theories that are kind of forcing people to always be happy and to always be pleasant and engaged in certain ways. But the undercurrent is that she's really angry and possibly schizophrenic, and she's taking all these meds to contain this other side of her. And at a certain point, her boss, who calls her a chore whore, just pushes her too far, and her family, who's rejected her, pushes her too far, and she breaks free from that emotional labor. And that's where the kind of horror comes in. She becomes a kind of violent force, but it's also where liberation comes in. And that movie has this beautiful touch where when she's kind of in touch with herself as this angry kind of figure of vengeance, she recites this poem by this communist, Paul Eluard, that was actually, I think it was dropped down on the sort of Vichy kind of France as a kind of anti-fascist poem. So she kind of recites that poem. So you can see like very explicitly that when she breaks free of her meds and of her emotional labor and of her new age bullshit, she ends up becoming, embracing this kind of liberation that can only be shown in these dark way, right? In these kinds of movies. And another movie that I think is really exquisite in kind of analyzing emotional labor is Parasite, where you see this whole family that are excellent at emotional labor, and they're so good that they go from being pizza box assemblers to being really well-paid domestic workers in this wealthy house and having access to all these luxuries in this house. But in the end, that emotional labor is kind of a trick on them. They never can break through the line that separates them from the real ruling class. And in fact, they end up falling lower than they started because of their deep belief that their own emotional labor will like lead to success. So it's a kind of, you know, the training in emotional labor is a way to kind of fool, you know, people into kind of working against their own interests. I kind of talk about at the beginning of this, you know, Sarah Ahmed's idea that of kind of retaking the idea of the feminist killjoy, where feminists are often called, you know, these dour, you know, humorless, unhappy people that ruin everything. And she's like, yeah, let's do that. Because if we do, we can stop performing the kinds of emotions that our bosses and our rulers want us to perform, and maybe find our own voices and just kind of seize on this being killjoy. And the films that I look at in that chapter, you know, show that kind of joy and liberation in kind of refusing emotional labor, as well as the pain that can be caused by believing that that emotional labor will lead to success.
Yeah, thanks. That chapter I found particularly useful in sort of figuring out what was going on, and I blame society because I very much enjoyed I Blame Society, but I had no idea what the point of it was. And I thought that was a really good, useful analysis of that. So yeah, thanks for that. And what can we say about violent women or violent girls in horror generally?
Yeah, so I think that kind of builds on, you know, what we were talking about. We can think of violence as a form of refusal. You know, I mean, obviously, women have been conditioned to be passive, and the ways that sort of women historically have been valued is for their kind of tenderness and care and nonviolent sort of a presence in the world. But that has been manipulated and mobilized for to kind of extract free labor from women. The kind of presence of a violent woman is really taboo, but it can be symbolizing a kind of throwing off of those stereotypes. And I think another thing that horror does really well in the way that it treats violence is it disrupts a myth where we always think of violence as coming from the outside of the stranger, of the scary other. And we never really acknowledge structural or systematic violence that characterizes our everyday lives. But in horror, we can kind of see women's violence as a reaction to these kind of everyday forms of horror. So like in the film Assassination Nation, it's kind of a rethinking of the Salem witch trials, where these women, their everyday lives, they're just constantly beset by kind of the threat of rape, the threat of male violence. If they had kind of taken the tack of being the good passive woman, they would just be victimized by this. But at a certain point, you know, they come together as a kind of gang that kind of, you know, and have vengeance on their tormentors. And it's incredibly satisfying to witness that as somebody, you know, who goes through that kind of everyday abuse and violence that's unacknowledged in our society. The other thing that I want to say about that is I've been influenced in the book. I kind of talk about one of these writers, but I feel like the work of Joshua Clover in Riot, Strike, Riot, and Mark Steven in a new essay that he wrote after I finished the book called A Screening Revolution are really interesting to help us think about left cinema in general and left kind of forms of activism in general, where both of them on kind of a different register are say, you know, our vision of what kind of leftist revolution is often structured by an outdated model where we think of perhaps like in film aesthetics, oh, the montage of like Soviet aesthetics, or, you know, in kind of protests of the union strike or the male proletariat with his big muscles and his factory tools, and all these ideas of what like leftist sort of revolt look like belong to a different era. And so people don't recognize when they see certain kinds of violence in contemporary representation or contemporary action, they just look at it as chaos or terrorism. They don't recognize it as revolt. But actually, the kind of form of the riot of spontaneous violence by a figure that is not the white male, blue-collar proletariat, but is the kind of surplus, feminized, racialized kind of other, this is in some ways the way that revolt is happening in response to our own moment. And I think that horror is the place where we can see the representation of this kind of violence as an inchoate form of political rebellion and refusal, as a riot that could and become a kind of collective response to the ways that so many people are considered surplus and outsiders and have no recourse to fight for themselves. Not to be too grandiose, but I think that that goes well with what Mark Steven says in Screening Revolution of, you know, if you really look, you can recognize this as an ongoing trend in contemporary cinema of showing that kind of what seems like as random violence is actually kind of signifying new forms of, you know, social revolt.
Yeah, and now I'm going to directly quote the book because this part hit pretty close to home. So, quote, "Life for millennials and Zoomers is virtually futureless. The choices on offer are to bow down in front of the shrine of meritocracy and spend the rest of one's life on a debt treadmill, or refuse and to consequently become an outlaw, if not a monster." So what do horror, you've kind of started talking about this already, but what do horror and monstrosity offer in a futureless world?
Yeah, so in that chapter, I have this idea of kind of, you know, coming of rage, where I look at horror films that talk about kind of young people and their sort of ways of becoming adults. In another genre, you know, the coming of age story, you know, is sort of about a lost teenager who figures out who they are and how to be in the world. But I think horror kind of has a realism to it, which doesn't put the onus of finding yourself on the individual, but recognizes the real cruelty and futurelessness that young people often see on the horizon. And also, you know, by recognizing that, again, kind of looking at their ways of fighting back. And so refusing the kind of myth of meritocracy that, oh, if we just try hard enough and ignore all the problems, I'll be that one person who makes it and has a future, and rather kind of implies that we need a collective response to these structural problems. So I look at films like It Follows, where you see a character who's Jay, she's coming of age, she's coming into her sexuality, she's going on a date, she's kind of falling in love, and she has sexual encounter, and instead of it signifying her turning into an adult, it inflicts her with a curse. And that curse is sort of a being that follows her. It's an it, but it takes different shapes. And all the different shapes represent these kinds of fears that are very realistic about the future. A homeless woman, a woman who's been sexually assaulted, somebody who seems to be an addict or mentally unwell, people that she knows but that she fears might not be quite what they seem. These different shapes follow her, kind of signifying her feeling of having a futureless future. My reading of the film is that at first, she kind of responds how you are supposed to respond in a meritocracy, which is by kind of passing that curse along. It's a sexually transmitted curse. So she just has, you know, sex with other people in hopes that she can just kind of get rid of it, right, and live her own life. But eventually her sort of closeness with her friends, who are all sort of disaffected youth who are kind of drifting and don't seem to have much future, they band together and they start to think about collective solutions to really get rid of this it, this curse once and for all. The film ends ambiguously, but I think that it has a kind of potential for the futureless future to lead to rebellion. And I look at this film called The Fits, which I really, you know, is a kind of small independent film that depicts this dance troupe from Cincinnati of young girls, young Black girls. And it's a really interesting take on the horror film in that it casts the girls in this dance troupe by a real dance troupe that is, you know, the same kind of class and is from Cincinnati. And it shows them they're coming of age, they're getting their period and going through puberty. But when they do, they're seized by this kind of fits and tremors, and they are shaking and possessed. It's some kind of disease that's hitting them with their puberty. And it does this really good job of kind of showing the vulnerability of these young Black girls who are surrounded by lack of social reproduction, that whose parents don't have time to spend time with them. And, you know, in a world that really ignores and neglects young, poor Black girls and adultifies them in a lot of ways. So, you know, rather than caring for them, incarcerates them. You see these images of cops like arresting 8-year-old girls, you know, for like acting out in their classrooms or something. And instead kind of showing the vulnerability that comes with coming of age, but somehow avoids being kind of rune porn, and also shows their sort of responses to their own affliction and kind of the creativity with which they face this affliction. So a lot of different approaches that I see in these kind of coming of age films, but this kind of ability to fight back against this othering and this infantilization. I look at a film called The Lure, which is I know we've kind of had different takes on it, but it's a kind of a mermaid musical horror comedy from Poland. But one thing I really like about it is that it kind of shows how young people are told, oh, you just have to take whatever, you're immature, you're a child, the real world is full of pain and austerity, and you're just too young to understand this. I see this kind of messaging through the film. As monsters, they're able to use their youth and their strength and their beauty to contest that and not listen to those messages and to fight back. It shows the bleakness of this featureless future, but also the hope. And you can see that in social movements where youth are so instrumental in, you know, Black Lives Matter and the Occupy movement, in, you know, the environmental movement. And so the very fact of being of lack of investment in the system can create a kind of reaction to it and a power to fight back.
Yeah, in terms of The Lure, I don't disagree with your analysis. I mean, I think the film's quite explicit about the sort of themes of gender violence and rebellion and exploitation and all that. I think my issue was more purely aesthetic. Like, I quite enjoyed the whole horror musical thing. I love Rocky Horror. I love Free Postnatic Opera. I love Happiness of the Categories. I know we're both fans of that one. The Lure, I guess, I just found the aesthetic. It was all a bit monochromatic, and I found it a little turgid, not fun to sit through. I think I might enjoy it more on a rewatch, knowing more what to expect, but it was just the aesthetic. I often find monochromatic stuff a little bit, like, hard to enjoy. Anyway, I agree with your analysis of it. It was more an aesthetic thing, really. Yeah, I mean, especially for a camp work, you know, for a musical, it's like, it's almost the opposite of Happiness of the Categories visually. Anyway, after all that kind of in-depth analysis, I think this question is much harder for a horror fan to answer. So if you had to recommend 5 horror films for somebody new to the genre but social justice minded, what would you recommend? I think we can leave Get Out because it sort of goes without saying. What would you say for 5 recommended horror films?
All right, so I kind of cheated on this because I couldn't quite do 5, but I have a list that I kind of wrote because I knew you were going to ask me that. And so I won't talk about them in any depth, but I wrote them in chronological order, and I'll skip the ones that we've already talked about. So I started with Cat People, which is from 1942.
Yeah.
Which has a kind of character. She's foreign. She's shown as sort of queer. She meets this kind of all-American guy and falls in love, but she can't be sexual with him. And it turns out that she's cursed from her hometown in Serbia of being like a monster that turns into a cat when she's too excited. And the gist of it that I love about it is that it kind of has these innocent American figures who end up living happily ever after, only after kind of dismissing her and having her menace, you know, disappeared. I feel like it's very sympathetic to her, and it really kind of shows the way that the sort of American dream of kind of the happy domestic life is really at the expense of anyone who disrupts it, who's foreign, who's queer, who's not normal in a certain way. And it does this in this very noirish, beautiful way. So, and then I put Stepford Wives, but we talked about that. I put Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1978. I like that one because it's kind of like right after the 60s and it's in San Francisco. So it's a very like left-wing place, and it's kind of populated by all these very idealistic characters who are trying to hold on to the values of the 60s. But it kind of shows the encroaching conservative culture in my reading, where the pod people that take over are just overwhelming and kind of, in some ways, you know, the Nixon era, the encroaching Reagan era is draining this vibrant population of their individuality and kind of imposing this rigidity on them. And it does this with this great kind of paranoid style and really strong acting. So I think that's a really fun one as a kind of introduction.
It's definitely a classic. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's beautiful.
Also an interesting one, because you mentioned in your reading, and I know there's a history of the idea of the Body Snatchers being about communism. And I think it's a really interesting one in that respect, because if you're a leftist, I mean, I think it's more so in the 70s one, it definitely doesn't read as much as anti-communist. But if you're a leftist, you see it as like ideology and this pervasive conformist ideology. But then maybe if you're seeing it from the right, a conformity of communism. I think it's just a really interesting sort of series of films in that respect, in terms of how audiences read that sort of increasing conformity in very, very opposite ways. But yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a Rorschach test. I totally agree with you. Yeah. And the first one, especially Don Siegel, I think, who directed the first one, and he wouldn't weigh in really on how you're supposed to read it, I think. So you kind of had your pick in that way. But yeah, I thought Society, it's kind of an obvious one. It's like the rich are just these aliens who like turn into this weird, like they do this process called the shunting, where they like fuse together and consume the poor. It's really over the top satire of the rich, but it's made kind of really extra by the special effects. This guy Screaming, this Japanese special effects artist called Screaming George, and he designs how the rich transform into these like flesh-eating monsters. It's just really obscene and dirty and surrealistic at the same time, and it kind of really is a kind of fun class war horror film.
I shouldn't comment on every film just for time, but in terms of Society, I just want to say the climactic scene, the shunting, I agree, it's great class war horror, but I also think that sequence, the screaming Mad George sequence, is like of body horror. That's pretty much the peak body horror effects sequence. So yeah, I definitely agree with that recommendation. Like, I think like Cronenberg movies are great, but in terms of that specific effect sequence, I think it's kind of the peak of body horror effects. But yeah.
Yeah, totally. And like, yeah, it's all couched in this class war narrative, but you can watch it just for that. I think it's really, really just fun and weird and beautiful. Actually, the next one, I'd love to hear your opinion, because I think I heard you kind of critique this movie, The People Under the Stairs, but I just like it because I think it kind of reverses so many of the tropes of more conservative horror, where you've got kind of black home invaders and kind of mutant children in the house of this white heteronormative couple who are called Mommy and Daddy, and they're supposed to be kind of Ronald and Nancy Reagan, but they're the evil ones and the actual home invaders are the kind of heroes. And so it kind of really reverses all those tropes, again, in a very campy sort of fun way. But did you have another take on that?
I don't remember what I may have said that might have been negative. I really love that movie. I really love Wes Craven. I think that's his most politically explicit kind of film, and he in general has good politics. So I'm not sure what I said that was negative about it. Maybe it's a bit on the stereotypical side. It's very broad, but that's very much like that works for the kind of style that it's doing. So I can't remember. I agree with you completely. It's a great movie.
Yeah, I think it was you were telling me at some point.
Yeah.
That there was debate, partially just because it was a white director. Maybe it wasn't your debate that you were having, but somebody else was having it. People have debated that point on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the question of a white director doing a film about essentially black rebellion, ultimately, and that it's very broadly drawn, I don't personally have a problem with the film. But yeah, I think that is a question, is how well it handles the sort of the depiction of the black community. I mean, the fact that Jordan Peele is planning a remake, I don't know if he's just producing or directing. Like, I'll be very interested to see what he does with the material. I mean, I think what, you know, as co-writer and producer, I think what he did with Candyman was great, where that's another white, kind of white liberal take on racism. he and others like Nia DaCosta and stuff kind of responded to it, you know, like they responded to the kind of white liberal take on racism. So I'll be interested to see what he did with the material, but I'm certainly a fan. I'm not someone who's going to denounce that film, but yeah.
Yeah, and I chose The New Candyman too as one of my picks for that, because I love exactly what you said, and also that the character Anthony that turns into the Candyman is at first like he's chosen as this kind of model minority that would be the artist that shows that gentrified Chicago is really diverse and vibrant, even after they've eradicated Cabrini-Greens and kicked out all the poor Black people, basically. At becoming Monster for him is giving up that role as like kind of the model for the gentrified world, and then becoming this figure of vengeance for the community that has disappeared as part of this chain of Candymen who've had that role of vengeance. But like you say, kind of rewriting that in a less ambiguous way that's kind of not really clear about what the politics and the lines are from the first Candyman. So yeah, maybe I'll leave it at that. I have some more, but what about you?
Yeah.
Do you have a top five?
Top five political horror? Off the top of my head, I mean, Night of the Living Dead, for sure. The original Night of the Living Dead, I think. Romero claims that it's not intended as a racial commentary, but I find it really hard to watch that and not see it as a major dimension of it. But yeah, really, really great film. And I'd recommend others from those series like Day of the Dead. I mean, these are well-known films, but I'd definitely pick Alien. I think that's a good kind of space capitalism film, you know, crew expendable. Yeah, Alien. Three more good political horrors. I feel like something from Wes Craven has to go on the list. I would agree People Under the Stairs is probably the best politically, but I think the politics of the original Nightmare on Elm Street are a bit underappreciated. So I'd recommend that, watching it from an, you know, it's obviously a very popular film, but I think the politics of it are underappreciated. And I think watching it from an angle of like repression of trauma and suburban repression of trauma and the way that puts young people in danger. So yeah, I'd put that on the list. What else? I mean, I guess Ari Aster is a big one. Did you have Midsommar on your list? I know you're a big fan of that. Oh, I think you had Hereditary maybe on your long list.
Yeah, so go ahead.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So Midsommar, great satire, white supremacy, cult dynamics, just really, really solid satire. Landed for me a lot more straightforwardly than Hereditary. So that's four. For a fifth, I guess I'll just say The Witch, which you've already talked about. That's off the top of my head. Pick those as my five, but yeah.
Pretty good, yeah. We should make a syllabus or something.
Yeah. In previous years, we've tried to do, we pick our one favorite horror movie from each decade. And we always end up picking a lot too many horror movies and ending up with like 6 hours of material, which we then have to cut down. So yeah, it's like the impossible question, you know, how to limit to like anything less than like 10 for any recommendations of horror. There's just too much good horror, you know, objectively to pick anything less than 10, I think. I mean, thanks for coming on. I very much recommend that people check out your work. So yeah, thanks for finally coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. We used to have a horror movie watching group together. I'm glad we got to reconnect and chat again.
We might be doing an episode for next Halloween. I think we're talking about picking a favorite queer horror film each. So, and we'll see how we go with narrowing those down. Again, thanks for coming along and thanks for listening, everyone. If you like what we do, please contribute to our Patreon at patreon.com/jetpack1917. And, you know, if you enjoyed Joe's work, you can check out the Blindfields Journal or the Facebook group Anti-Capitalist Feminists Who Like Horror Films, as well as obviously the book Stepford Daughters, very much worth a read. So yeah, thanks for listening and we'll see you in the future.
You have seen this incident based on sworn testimony. Can you prove that it didn't happen? We once laughed at the horseless carriage, the aeroplane, the telephone, the electric light, vitamins, radio, and even television. And now some of us laugh in outer space. God help us in the future.